You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining today's Brookings event. It's time for an infrastructure boost, confronting utility bill affordability during the COVID-19 recession. My name is Adi Tomer, and I'm a fellow at the institution where I help lead our infrastructure work. We know time is precious these days. Young children are at home, Zoom calls and college classes are endless, and we're all a bit exhausted. Thank you for spending even a small bit of your day with us. In the midst of a global pandemic and economic recession, the country has no shortage of major crises to manage. Today, we want to discuss one that often gets overlooked by those fortunate enough to never worry about it, the price of essential infrastructure services. Keeping the lights on, the water running, the modem blinking, and your car running all commands a significant amount of money. And for many Americans, the combination of all those bills is too much. Now, with permanent and temporary layoffs on the rise, we're seeing the chilling effects of little to no safety net around consumer prices. Water and electricity shutoffs are increasing. Students streaming classes are eclipsing their families' data caps. Car notes are going unpaid at the same time transit service is getting cut. This is no way to deliver an inclusive economic recovery. And with the colder months coming and COVID-19 a persistent threat, staying safe and productive inside our homes is of the utmost importance. The United States is wealthy enough to do more, and that's what we're here to discuss today. Our first panel, moderated by my colleague Joe Kane, will begin to unpack the affordability challenge through the lens of different infrastructure expertise. Following that discussion, I'll moderate a second panel focused on potential solutions, including lessons from the financial service industry and public nutrition programs. Remember, you can submit questions via Twitter throughout the morning. We'll be monitoring and doing our best to pose them to the panelists. But to kick off today's conversation, we are delighted to have Mayor Byron Brown of Buffalo, New York. Mayor Brown is now in his fourth term leading the city, and his accomplishments in the local and statewide community are sizable. That includes, today, a direct response to the affordability crisis. As the mayor and his regional collaborators have made water affordability and overcoming the digital divide, among other issues, chief concerns during this challenging economic moment. Even better for the rest of us, the mayor should be feeling good after the Bills and the Bills Mafia scored a nice start to the NFL season on Sunday. Mayor Brown, thank you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. We are certainly feeling very good in Buffalo about the Bills' win for their season opener, and also that the Toronto Blue Jays are playing their home games in Buffalo. Good morning, and allow me to thank Brookings for the opportunity to speak about the importance of water delivery infrastructure. It is my belief that access to clean water is vital to economic, environmental, and the social health of a city. That is why I've made affordable and safe water availability a cornerstone of my administration's approach to growth and equity. I want to recognize the leadership of the general manager of the Buffalo Sewer Authority and the chair of the Buffalo Water Board, O.J. McFoy, as well as our commissioner of the Department of Public Works, Michael Finn. Access to water is a right that every resident should be able to enjoy without it being the cause of economic hardship. While there is a cost to delivering this service, covering those costs must not become a burden that endangers anyone's ability to afford their housing, other utilities, or enjoy a good quality of life. That's why my administration and the Buffalo Water Authority introduced our Water Equity Roadmap. This comprehensive plan emphasizes water affordability for Buffalo's low-income residents and help generate support for the launching of our water affordability program in 2019, which can reduce the water bills of struggling homeowners by 20 to 60%. Enrollment in the program was designed to be very easy and accessible to eliminate any barriers to assistance that the most vulnerable residents too often face when trying to access government assistance. Almost 700 people have enrolled in this program so far. Anyone who qualified for the county's heating assistance program or received nutrition assistance is automatically enrolled. Others can fill out a simple application that only takes 10 minutes to complete and can be done online. And the program does not discriminate between homeowners and renters. Anyone who uses Buffalo water is able to participate. In addition to affordable water, it is also a priority of my administration to ensure that Buffalo's water is safe. In 2019, with the use of approximately $500,000 in state funding, the city launched the Replace Old Lead Lines or Roll program to help residents who experience a break or other damage to their water line maintain a healthy and lead-free water supply. In the past, residents, especially in our poorest neighborhoods, would opt to repair rather than replace broken or damaged water lines. The cost of repairing them was significantly lower, and many thought it was just as safe. As we know, repaired lead lines present a significant danger to the health of residents because the repair disturbs lead particles and contaminates the drinking water flowing through the line. Roll allows residents to replace those lines at no cost. So far, the program has helped over 300 residents, and every Buffalo Water residential customer is able to purchase low-cost insurance to protect their water lines through our partnership with a company called HomeServe, a well-known utility services insurance provider. Through this effort, we are not only updating Buffalo's water infrastructure, but also providing low-income residents the ability to become more financially secure through the purchase of this affordable insurance plan that will protect their home's water in the future. The COVID-19 global health pandemic has been a terrible reminder of how critical clean and affordable water is to individuals and to our society as a whole. Water is critical to maintaining the level of hygiene necessary to combat the spread of the virus and other infectious diseases. And when people are experiencing water insecurity, they are placing the health of the entire community at risk. That is why, as part of my administration's response to COVID-19, we suspended all water shutoffs that were related to non-payment. We also proactively reached out to every home where the water had been turned off so we could arrange for it to be turned back on, helping hundreds of residents in our community. In July, I also announced our water amnesty program. This initiative is open to all city residents who are behind on their water bills and waives the insurance rate and penalties associated with the customer's account balance. This proactive approach to ending water insecurity will help people pay for their service while our shutoff suspension is in effect and people can maintain a clean water supply as the public health crisis continues. To date, over 600 households have utilized this program. By taking these steps, My administration is reaffirming its commitment to making sure every resident can benefit from the investments and upgrades we are putting in to our water system. As I said at the opening of my statement, water is critical to the growth of Buffalo and is imperative that our future growth leaves no resident behind. Our focus is building a city of opportunity for all residents so that no resident is left out and no resident is left behind. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about water affordability in the city of Buffalo.
Thank you, Mayor Brown. It's terrific to hear about your efforts in Buffalo, and I think they set the stage very well for our panels today. Good morning, everyone. My name is Joe Kane. I'm an infrastructure researcher at the Brookings Metro Program, and I'll be moderating our first panel on defining and measuring affordability. As Adi and Mayor Brown have already described, infrastructure affordability is a big challenge for many households across the country. That's especially true during the current pandemic and recession, but it's also been the case for some time. It's just more visible now, given just how much we recognize the importance of our essential infrastructure every day. Water, energy, broadband, transportation, and other bills have been an economic stress, especially for lower-income households. From the perspective of utilities and other infrastructure operators, though, we also know that there's a constant balancing act between affordability and investment. The financial and economic needs of our communities can vary widely. Geographic scale matters, the operational scale matters, and the needs of individual ratepayers matter too. So there's a lot to unpack here over the next 25 minutes or so, but I'm very excited to have three panelists lead our conversation and get a better handle on all this around the what, the where, and for whom. That should hopefully set things up well for the second panel that will cover more of the how or how we address this challenge. And I also wanted to remind our viewers that you can submit questions at any time by emailing events@brookings.edu or tweeting using the hashtag InfraBoost. So first, we have Radhika Fox, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the U.S. Water Alliance, a national nonprofit advancing policies and programs that build a sustainable water future for all. Radhika is a widely recognized leader on a whole bunch of water issues, from water equity to water infrastructure investment. So we're really excited to have her join us today, especially so early on the West Coast. So thank you, Radhika. Next, we have Diana Hernandez, who is an assistant professor of sociomedical sciences at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Diana's community-oriented research examines the intersections between the built environment, poverty, equity, and health, with a particular emphasis on energy and security. So it should be a tremendous addition to the conversation. And last, but certainly not least, we have Tom Wheeler, who is the former chair of the Federal Communications Commission and currently a visiting scholar in the Brookings Governance Studies program. Many of you have probably heard of or met Tom, but he brings over four decades of experience and leadership in telecommunications as a business leader, author, and more. So Tom, it's an honor to have you here as well. So let's start with the broad question, right? What is affordability? In other words, what is the challenge and how does that challenge vary by the particular type of infrastructure, be it water, energy, broadband? We know there's many different concerns, right, in each sector, but probably parallel concerns too. So Radhika, let's start with you, just your initial take for a couple minutes on this admittedly big topic.
Yeah. Well, Joe, I wanted to first thank you and Brookings for hosting this conversation. You know, this is United for Infrastructure Week, where we talk about how we need to elevate the importance of infrastructure and greater investment in it. And, you know, when it comes to the water sector, I think that the affordability issue is really the flip side of the historic lack of investment, enough investment in our water infrastructure. I think you're right, Joe, that the current COVID-19 pandemic has really highlighted for the nation the issues of water, the lack of water access, the water affordability crisis. We've, you know, seen so many stories about shutoffs and people making really hard choices, families making hard choices around, am I going to pay my water bill? Or am I going to pay my groceries? You know, and that's a terrible circumstance to be in. But for lower income people and communities of color, the issue of water affordability has been there and is growing as a crisis for many, many years. And it relates to this issue of lack of investment in our infrastructure. Back in the 70s, you know, we had this federal investment that it was a legacy generational investment that helped us build the drinking water and wastewater systems that people enjoy today. But those were never maintained because of politics, local politics, and being able to raise rates in order to continue to invest in those systems. And so now we're at a place where those systems are aging, they're failing. Local cities like Mayor Brown that we just heard from have to increase rates in order to make those investments. And so how do we keep those affordable, I think, is the big challenge. So these issues of affordability and investment in infrastructure are just completely intertwined in the water sector.
Yeah, that's great, Radhika. And you know, I'm a big fan of water infrastructure, so it's great to see it being kind of infrastructure issue number one today. But we know there are many other sectors at play, and water is often closely overlapped with energy, for example. And so, Diana, I know a lot of your work has focused on issues of sort of energy insecurity, particularly as it relates to housing considerations. Do you see some of the same concerns that Radhika was referencing or other issues that you've uncovered in some of your work?
Yeah, well, just to echo Radhika and thanking you, Joe, and just this panel, to me, it's so important to be thinking about these issues as bundled, because in fact, in the lived experience, these are bundled hardships. They're economic hardships that really force those trade-offs, as Radhika was mentioning. Oftentimes, it's, you know, housing costs, food, medicine, transportation, water, property taxes, and then, you know, Wi-Fi telecommunications. And that is, in fact, the bundle of goods that are necessary, but that also really force those hard choices and the trade-offs that come. In my work, I also kind of examine the health consequences of those hardships. And what it actually means to answer the question very specifically about, you know, the debate around how to measure affordability in the energy space. There are, I would say, kind of a competing concept. So energy burden has received a lot of attention. There is moderate energy burden, which is measured at 6% of household income. So it's a ratio between expenditures and household income. And then there's severe energy burden, which is anything in excess of 10% of household income that's allocated to energy. In the water space, it's 2.5 to 3%. In housing, it's 30%. And as you start to look at it, especially when you're working with a small budget to begin with, if you start kind of chopping down just on the basis of what these established metrics look like, You imagine that, you know, it starts to get really difficult for people as they are many times exceeding those basic metrics. So the point being that, you know, these are important considerations to appreciate together and to know that many people do without, many low-income families and households do without in order to make do.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, on the one hand, you think tough choices, but there really is no choice, right? I mean, you can't choose, well, I'm going to pay my water bill versus my energy bill versus something else. I mean, these are all necessities, right? And I think you're totally right. It's a bundle, right? It's a bundle of services, not just deciding on one bill versus the other, but how do we better define and gauge all of this collectively? And so, I mean, I think, you know, Tom, I think that's in some ways a good pivot to you. We wouldn't even be able to have this event today, right? If we each weren't probably paying our own broadband bills, right? And so, you know, talk about the essential infrastructure of the moment of even making an event like this possible. You know, how are we thinking about affordability in the broadband space, both, you know, nationally, but relative to some of the issues that you've been exploring recently? I know you came out with a great piece the other day highlighting some of these issues, particularly for lower income households. But I'd be just curious what some of your impressions are.
Well, thank you, Joe. And thank you to you and ID both for setting this up with Brookings. You know, there everybody has talked about what the broadband future will look like. Well, we're living it, as you said, right? I mean, right now, COVID, if anything, one of the effects has been to speed up the that broadband future and the importance of broadband to all of us, but particularly the importance to low-income Americans who, as Radhika and Diana have mentioned, have to worry about how am I going to have water, how am I going to have heat and light, and now how am I going to get connected? You know, almost 10 million American students don't have access to broadband at home at the very time when they can't go to school and school's telling them you got to get online. And the reason they don't have access is because they can't afford it. You know, 60% of the people who live in homes that are passed, 60% of low-income Americans who live in homes that are passed by broadband have had to make the decision, no, I'm not going to bring it into my house because I can't afford it. You know, the average broadband price in the United States today is a little over $60. That's a lot of money when you stack it up against having to pay for water, having to pay for rent, having to pay for food, you know, et cetera. And that's one of the highest prices in the world. So the challenge that we have is how are we going to adapt programs that were adopted in a different era to solve the challenges of the broadband era? The Federal Communications Commission, for instance, has a Lifeline program, which was put in by the Reagan administration so that everybody had a low-cost telephone line to call 911. We need to make sure that those kinds of funds get and a similar kind of program gets adopted for broadband. The FCC also has the E-rate program, which spends billions of dollars a year to make sure that America's classrooms are connected to the internet. But classrooms today aren't in school buildings. The FCC ought to be changing their definition to say, yes, we can use that money to make sure that low-income Americans with students at home can go online. So we've got a very high importance of broadband. We've got a particular importance to the low-income segment of society. We've got programs in place that could be doing something, but in the Trump world, are not.
Right. No, I you're right, Tom, in the sense of, you know, thinking of the different purposes of these services, right? And what are the impacts, right, for those who can't afford or can't access or plug in, as the case may be, to these services. And it has a difference for education. It has a difference for our health. It has a difference for applying for a job, right? Right. For hygiene, and that all matters, especially now, but it's always been true. And I think that's, you know, it's a good lead into to sort of the second question I had that I think I'll just open up to all of you. But, you know, we know affordability is a national issue, right? It's one that varies by geography, though, right? Urban, rural, suburban. And we know it has been or has not been addressed by federal, state, and local efforts. And so I know, Diana, you were starting to mention this a little bit with, you know, measurement and, you know, sort of where as we're trying to get our hands around just sort of what the challenge is, you know, how do we begin to take steps that better define sort of the scale, the location, even the intensity of this challenge? You know, are there current efforts, you know, be it we heard what Buffalo's doing around some of this, right? We know there are some existing federal efforts around this for broadband, not not so much necessarily in terms of water as Radhika knows. You know, there's some benchmarks around this, but I know there've been many conversations of revising those benchmarks. So I kind of open up to all of you, you know, how should we be thinking about measuring this, and are we measuring it? Maybe Diana, we'll just start with you since you brought that up in your initial comments.
Yeah, happy to do that. So just in terms of measurement, 1 in 3 households in the United States is energy insecure, and that's 37 million, and that is before all of COVID. And just to put that in context, there are about 17 to 18 million households that are food insecure. And that measurement comes from the USDA. When they started to measure food insecurity, it also propelled a certain policy and action around addressing food insecurity and addressing hunger in America. And until we get to the point where we're more accurately kind of measuring the prevalence rate of water insecurity and food insecurity, food insecurity is so well established, but energy insecurity, and certainly in the broadband and telecommunications space, it's important. But one of the other pieces to this is the kind of harsh consequences of not being able to pay utility bills. And Radhika kind of mentioned the notion of disconnection. And to date, we don't really have a good handle on disconnections in the water space, certainly not in the energy space. But the best kind of available data comes from the Residential Energy Consumption Survey, their 2015 panel. And we know that it's almost 3% of back in 2015 of households in the United States that were disconnected. Many more, about 15%, that actually had a threat of disconnection. And there again, a lot of evidence around evictions and the harsh consequences of evictions has also led to, you know, different policies and protections around, you know, kind of allowing space for that not to happen. And we see that occurring in the context of COVID. What is really important is to get to the point where we could say the same thing about water issues, about broadband, about telecommunications and energy, so that, you know, the $112 bill, electricity bill, which is the average electricity bill in the United States, doesn't cause people to literally have their lights off, but that we actually have solutions so that folks aren't facing those harsh consequences on the disconnection side.
I mean, I would love to build on what Diana said, because she's absolutely right. I mean, in the context of water, we don't have a good comprehensive national view around the affordability challenge. And Joe, I will say this would be a great project for Brookings and the amazing researchers, right? But part of, so individual local public water agencies who are maybe mapping and tracking their customers may know this, but we don't have a good national number. But I will say the short answer is that every community has a water affordability challenge. And there's a funny conundrum that we face, because on the one hand, water service is generally affordable for most people. It's really the lowest income, and how we both increase water rates, frankly, for those who can afford to pay, including probably most of the listeners, but then maintain that affordability for low-income people is the thing we have to figure out. Diana mentioned the EPA affordability metric that a family shouldn't pay more than 2.5%. That is a flawed metric, frankly. It is a blunt number, and it really, and I think EPA recognizes that, and they're actively working to think about alternative definitions of affordability, but it is a blunt target because it looks across a service area, it looks across income, it doesn't take into account community context, and that's what we need. What gives me some optimism around this, though, is we do really see some local water agencies who are really thinking in more innovative ways around how to understand affordability. So, for example, you know, some of them are saying, let's understand who's the population in my service area that is 200% below the poverty line. How do we pay attention to them? Or as we're thinking about affordability, how do we better segregate the lowest 20% income in my service area and think about targeted programs there versus the overall population. So I think some innovations are happening, frankly, at the local level, and hopefully the federal government will learn from, and as Tom said, adapt these programs accordingly.
So let me drop a little good news into this discussion, Joe. You know, in the past week or so, the broadband industry in the United States has voluntarily launched a program called the Bridge to Broadband, which does two things. First of all, they are going to measure where are those homes we talked about a minute ago who are passed by broadband but can't afford broadband and have a student in them. And then they're turning around to cities and school districts and saying, for those homes, we're going to have a special price. You know, I mean, you know, the wireless, the broadband industry has already done the responsible thing of stepping up and saying that, you know, for instance, Comcast Internet Essentials were $9.95 special rate per month for broadband access. And they're going to go beyond that now to talk about those 10 million students that don't have access to the internet. That's the really good news. The bad news is that Mayor Brown in Buffalo and his colleagues are going to have to come up with the cash to pay for that price. It may be a reduced price, but they're still going to have to come up with the cash to pay for it at a time when revenues are down and their other COVID-related costs are up. And the worst news is that the Trump FCC, as we discussed before, that has a couple of programs that it could turn around and target to do something to help this voluntary industry program work for 10 million students are sitting on their hands. And the chairman of the Trump FCC actually, when asked about what he felt about this this industry program, said it's a great idea. And there's money in the COVID bill that the cities ought to use. And yes, there was money in the COVID bill to help with education, but it was all of the increased costs resulting from COVID in the delivery of education. And you can't hide behind that. You got to say, we've got programs that were designed to assure the connectivity of Americans, specifically low-income Americans, and we ought to use them for broadband. But we're not doing that.
Yeah, it's you know, when all of you are talking about this, it's like, well, I figured, you know, Radhika is going to be the water person and Diana is going to be the energy person and Tom's just going to talk about broadband. It's like, well, no, it all comes together, right? Even as we talk about this and measure it. And I think, you know, in the limited time that we have, I want to leave time for questions, of course. So we'll have this last one be kind of a lightning question, but it's, I think, probably one of the most important questions you know, is we can talk about, I love the word, Radhika, blunt, right? Of, you know, we have these blunt measures and we can put, you know, certain numbers around all of this and, you know, quantify it. And we have to do that, right? We have to be very, the devil's in the details when it comes to really defining these issues, but we have to think, you know, affordability for whom, right? I mean, it's about people, it's about households. And we need, by we, it's probably federal, state, local, need to be targeted and intentional about how any sort of assistance may or may not work in terms of eligibility, in terms of the timing of these efforts. And Tom, as you hit the nail on the head, I mean, the timing is of the essence right now. I mean, it's just something clearly has to give. So, you know, I'll just open up to all of you, you know, who is the priority when we think about these affordability concerns? Of course, you know, all households need these services, right, regardless of income. But we know when it comes to paying for these services, some of the lower income households struggle the most. And so just, you know, quickly, I'm just curious of your take on sort of the affordability for whom question.
Well, I think it has to be affordability for all. In a nation of such abundance, it's shameful that people don't have some basic access to housing, food, water, energy, broadband. And I think Deanna said it the best, that we have to design these policies based on the lived experience of people, right? The stress and trauma that people face when they have to make choices between a grocery bill and a water bill, they have to fill out three or four different forms to be able to get some of the subsidy programs that really were designed to be the safety net, that has to stop. And what I would just say is, if not now, when? If we cannot have a humane and compassionate response around affordability for infrastructure services at this moment of COVID-19, when will we as a nation?
Who can add anything to that? If not now, when? That's it.
Time is of the essence, and home has never been more important, right? I mean, if we learned anything about COVID, is that, you know, the primary infrastructure that people interact with is their home. And so thinking about for whom, the evidence is really clear. We know that households with low-income households, Black and Latino households, households with children, elderly, people living in mobile homes, people living in homes that report inadequate insulation, people living in rural areas and also multifamily buildings in cities are all disproportionately impacted by energy insecurity. It's not a question about being able to target and know the demographics. And we know the kind of correlates around the hardship. But we have to think not just about bill assistance, for instance, which is how it's played out in the context of energy. But we also have to make sure to couple that with energy efficiency efforts, right? That, you know, if people are paying more because the infrastructure of their homes means that they have not just a diminished quality of life, but also more costs associated with it. It's a problem. And we see that in the water infrastructure as well. We have, I mean, it's kind of like what the mayor was saying, lead pipe issues and water quality issues in the home. So I would say, you know, the real kind of simple answer is we know who to target. We just haven't done enough around rate variability and the accommodations that are necessary to make, kind of affordable infrastructure available to everyone. And we should.
Right. And I think, you know, as much as it's easy to just focus and fixate on the challenge and, you know, the struggles, which are real and they're visceral and they're very widespread, they're everywhere. There are positive stories unfolding here too, you know, as you know, Mayor Brown demonstrated in Buffalo. That's one of many examples. And perhaps, you know, there's momentum building in certain places among certain leadership nationally around these issues. And so having these sorts of conversations, I think, is helpful to highlight, you know, where those examples are kind of taking place and maybe where there is possibility for not just measuring, but actually reaching more people. So, you know, I have a bunch of great questions here from our audience. And I know we only have about 7 minutes or so until the next panel. So I'll try to break it up in different chunks and then try to get through as many as we can. But Tom, I think I'll start with you since a few of these are directed towards broadband specifically, although Radhika and Diana, you're more than welcome to hop in here too. You know, there's several questions, Tom, that we've received on sort of ensuring broadband is available to low-income households and communities, but the struggles, right, of kind of where we are at the moment, almost in terms of the models that are in place. And so there's this great question from Jane Brown at the Robert Deutsch Foundation, who says, you know, what needs to happen for broadband to rightfully be legally treated as a utility when we think of, you know, how we're even managing both these affordability questions, but obviously other questions too?
So I guess the first question that I've got on that is whether or not broadband is a utility. Okay. I mean, a utility is something that is so important that government must provide it. You know, Radhika, the other day on a conversation we were having, talked about how 80% of the water in the United States is provided by local governments. But I do think that we need to, there's a difference between utility and what we call a common carrier, which is a critical service that needs to be regulated in a way that recognizes that criticality. And that's the challenge we have. You know, when we were at the FCC in the Obama administration, we passed a rule that said that all ISPs, internet service providers, broadband service providers, were common carriers and were subject to specific rules of common carriage, including standby authority to regulate rates if that was necessary. The Trump FCC, as soon as they came in, immediately repealed that. But we've got to come to grips with the fact that we are dealing with a critical service that ought to have a regulatory oversight plan that that reflects that criticality.
Gotcha. No, and I know, Tom, you could probably talk about that for an hour here about each of these questions. So that's terrific. And I think actually in some ways leads to, you know, related questions on some of the other infrastructure sectors. Radhika received a great question from our friend Emily Lamb at the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, who said, you know, how can we get federal or state funds to help fund ratepayer assistance programs, right? So there's this kind of this, as we have been talking about, sort of this challenge in, you know, federal sort of national regulation oversight of this, but also just real concerns of at the local level, right? Of, well, how do we pay for all of this in addition to everything else that's on our plate at the moment, especially in the current pandemic? And so I know you've talked to many, many utilities across the country that might be thinking about these same questions. Have you heard anything from them or anything in your work to help answer Emily's question?
Yeah, and I will just have to say, Emily, kudos for being up at 7:30 in the morning for this conversation. You're obviously very committed on these issues. So I would say three things. One is, in the context of the various, COVID relief and recovery discussions, a lot of really good solutions to water affordability have been debated. Some are about how do we leverage programs like LIHEAP and provide resources directly to families. There's other proposals out there around how do we get resources to the public agencies to then provide relief that way. So either both would be great solutions. I think the problem is we have to get that over the finish line. And to me, I think it's shameful that, you know, we, for example, have provided hundreds of millions of dollars to subsidize airports, very important essential infrastructure service, but water agencies haven't gotten a penny. And they are really both struggling, and the families that they serve are struggling. As far as how we get it done, I think that now is a moment where we need to build a coalition of people who are focused advocates for families, who are concerned around affordability, human rights, civil rights, and the infrastructure providers, the water agencies, the electric providers, the broadband providers, because if we can create a coalition of equity advocates and infrastructure providers, I think we can have a powerful voice on Capitol Hill to actually get many of the very good proposals over the finish line.
Right. I think that's well said, in the sense of, you know, how is there collaboration, you know, big, greater sort of economies of scale almost to some of these challenges that can be very fragmented and localized, but are really true at a national scale too. Diana, you know, I wish I had more time to ask you even more questions, all three of you, but Diana, your question that's more related on the energy side. So we received from Sarah King at the Cleveland Foundation, you know, what's going to happen if electricity is turned off in homes that can't afford payment, especially, you know, local school kids, right, who can't use internet, right? So you know, as we've been talking about these different challenges, right, it's almost like a domino effect, right, where you have, you can't afford your power bill, well, then you probably aren't going to be able to have internet, right? And then maybe you also can't have water. So as we think of, you know, there are some households that are dealing with this, maybe the moratoria for shutoffs have helped protect some of these households in the past few months, but we know that those moratoria aren't going to last forever necessarily. So this is a real challenge that's going to be unfolding. So what would you say to leaders as we think about some of those households that are about to or already seeing some of these electricity shutoffs?
Well, we know what happens when people are shut off. We know that there's a disruption in family life, right? That people end up, you know, visiting and staying for kind of long hauls with their family members. We also know that they are making these forced trade-offs. When it comes to families with children, there are states that mandate reporting. And in that case, it triggers calls to child protective service agencies. And that becomes a problem, not necessarily of negligence on the parent's part, but really, to the points that were made earlier about negligence and recognizing this as an issue. The way that I think we should move forward is that we kind of take a rights-based approach to many of these issues. If we had a rights-based approach to energy, to water, to broadband, we would, you know, kind of invest in the necessary infrastructure, right? The best available, the most efficient. People would have access to healthy, sustainable energy sources. They would also have the right to affordable energy and the right to uninterrupted energy services, so that when families are actually facing these challenges, they have alternatives. Because one of the challenges right now around the question of affordability, and we see it in housing too, is that there isn't bill forgiveness is not part of the equation. So we have the moratoriums around shutoffs, and that's also true seasonally when it comes to energy. But then people are shut off from, you know, like the spring months if you're in the Northeast, for instance. So we have to be thinking about this from a more humane perspective, recognizing that this is necessary for everyday life. It's absolutely essential for modern day living. And that maybe we, you know, kind of have to define this from a rights-based place so that people aren't having to kind of unnecessarily deal with these traumas. And the kind of downward spiral that could include not just evictions, but death. If people don't have access to electricity and they are dependent on medical equipment, it could literally mean life or death for some folks. And so that, to me, is unacceptable.
Yeah.
Joe, let me pile on there for 1 second.
Sure.
This Deanna just said a great thing. This isn't about water. This isn't about energy. This isn't about broadband. This is about people. And that's what we can't afford to lose focus on.
Tom, I think I can't beat that. I am, I'm going to let that be the exclamation point to, this conversation, just speaking for myself, has been tremendous. I have left with so many notes and takeaways, and, you know, coming in, having, you know, caught up with you guys last week, I knew there'd be a lot of parallels and commonalities, but I wouldn't even know whether, Radhika, you were talking about water, or Tom, you're talking about broadband. I mean, at the end of the day, this is something that, an issue that deals so much with people and how that's translated across different types of households and sort of the stacking of these services as sort of that basket that's so essential is the way we have to think about this. And so hopefully that's helpful for our next panel on all right, how are we going to do something about this? So Radhika, Tom, Diana, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your continued leadership on these issues and look forward to keeping the conversation going even after.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
Great. So I'm going to pass it now over to, or back to, Adi, who's going to be leading our second panel, who in the next 30 minutes is going to solve the affordability challenge. So Adi, it's off to you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. And this feels like we're on like some kind of weird news network and we get to do like the handoff at the top of the hour. That was great. First of all, thanks for moderating it. And you could really see their conversation bounded around the idea of not just people, which is of course essential to this, But the commonalities across these different sectors. So we're going to broaden even more. I want to invite the panelists for the second panel to kind of turn on their feeds, as it were, right? Come to the stage in old analog terms. We are excited to actually expand the conversation even more. As if infrastructure wasn't a big enough sector to start with, let's bring in folks who have even a wider set of expertise, as well as you'll meet Josh here in a second, who also has a mix of expertise as well as transportation. We haven't even talked about transportation much yet. And I think it speaks to both how big this infrastructure sector is. And as you kind of heard ringing out both from the mayor as well as the panelists, I mean, people are really hurting. And in particular, all three of the prior panelists talked about this preceded COVID too. This is only something that's right and exacerbated effectively, but it's getting worse. You know, let's speak, we're talking about people, so let's speak in human terms today. People are really struggling and there's a lot we can do. So I am delighted to have the panelists join us for this second panel. I'm going to introduce them in alphabetical order. We're going to try to go, or at least I'm going to try to go fast so we can leave as much space for you three to speak about these really critical topics. So first we have Stacey Dean, who's the Vice President for Food Assistance Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Stacey has unparalleled experience working at the nexus of both household opportunity and public nutrition programming. We really, really appreciate you bringing your knowledge here today. Thanks, Stacey.
Thank you.
Next is Josh Goldman, who's Director of Strategy and Business Development at VIA, who many of you probably know VIA's products as one of the most innovative transportation companies operating in metro areas today. What some of you may not see is the incredible work that VIA does behind the scenes, working with many cities on other routing technologies and other kind of similar digital tech interventions. And Josh also has some experience working in the federal government too, so he can see it on both sides today. And then finally, to continue the theme, we have Melissa Coide, who's the president and director of FinReg Lab. Formerly, Melissa was the U.S. Treasury Department's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Consumer Policy. Melissa, we are so lucky to have your expertise, in particular around financial inclusion today, which is something that has been kind of looming around the conversation, but let's get really explicit about it right away. And Melissa, as you know, I want to start with you. The issue of financial inclusion is so central to these issues. It's complementary, but it's also connected, right? And that makes for some interesting food for thought, in particular for a lot of infrastructure folks. Probably that's the bulk of our listeners say, they often think in project terms, right? It's like civil engineering or calculus, right? This is something different, but it's deeply connected to that human scale. So what are some of the challenges around financial inclusion broadly that you're seeing kind of resonate, at least through the conversation we've heard today?
Sure. Thank you for having me, Adi. It's wonderful to be a part of this conversation, which is so critical. And the first panel was fantastic. Between when we did the prep session and this morning, I actually went back and spent a fair bit of time thinking about the variety of ways that while sitting at the U.S. Treasury a couple of times, and even in between, we have been really focused in how we build a plumbing or an infrastructure that enables not just households and families to have access to the ability to transact and save and build wealth, but really importantly, basic government-provided supports. And so I'll bring some of those insights to today's conversation with you. But I think for starters, for the audience, it would be really helpful to set the context about what is happening in this country in terms of households, families, and individuals, but importantly also small businesses, lack of access to our financial system and what that means in terms of both cost, but also the ability to access basic payment services and facilitate basic financial and economic activity. So to start, in the U.S., we have, according to the FDIC, almost 7% of households in the U.S. who are unbanked. That was as of 2017, that the latest survey data will be coming out soon. That's about 8.4 million households across the country. These are people who don't have access to basic banking services, a checking or a savings account. And it is important to know that this is somewhat of a fluid number. People are in and out of access to financial products and services. But we also have another 18.7% of U.S. households who we deem underbanked. And that is, they may or may not have a savings account, but they're also turning to alternative types of financial products and services, check cashing services, payday loan services, to really meet those basic needs, whether that's access to short-term credit because they've got a bill that they need to pay, or they need to cash that utility or that cash that payroll check because they've got a utility payment they need to make. And those expenses can really start to add up. Importantly, too, these rates are much higher among African-American and Latino populations, which account in those populations, African-American populations have account access at 84%. And among Latino households, 86% have access. So there are big differences there in terms of who's going without basic financial services. COVID has made all of this all the more apparent to us what the real limitations are when people don't have the ability to access the financial system. We delivered government benefits payments, the CARES Act support through our financial system. And there we had millions of people who were waiting for the ability to access those monies. And we at FinReg Lab have spent a fair bit of time looking at the challenges, especially for minority business owners and small business owners, and the fact that they didn't have the connections to the financial system, what that meant in terms of their inability to access the PPP monies. So why is all of this happening? And frankly, many of us who've been thinking about financial inclusion issues for over 20 years, have seen some improvements in terms of numbers over time. And we've seen some improvements in terms of both what the financial sector has been able to do in terms of leveraging technology and data to provide more responsive products and services to households. But yet we still have, as the numbers I just presented tell you, significant populations who are left without access. So why is this? There are access challenges, and I hope we're going to talk about this in more detail. Are you who you say you are is a critical question for getting into the financial system. It is a critical question for accessing benefits. And there are real challenges, both in terms of the sort of typical process by which the financial sector identifies individuals for access to the financial system. And at the same time, there are real concerns and costs associated with fraudulent activities. And those costs have real bearing in terms of the financial sector's appetite for building products that are responsive to, if you will, non-traditional people who have non-traditional types of identity, ways of being identified. The timing and access to funds is a really big deal. The fact that it can take 3 weeks for monies to actually be accessible when they've hit your account, that's a tremendous limitation for households who have bills that need to be paid immediately and frankly, probably a couple of weeks back. And the timing of access to those funds is relevant in the context of paychecks, benefits, irregular incomes, and remittance services. And then there are also important challenges that still exist around just lack of comfort with more traditional financial institutions. We have areas where we have banking deserts. We have, you know, communities who have just felt over generations that they're not welcome into more traditional institutions. The things that we spend a fair bit of time thinking about at FinReg Lab are where are these data options, the potential of using data for solving some of the cost issues, for solving some of the efficiency issues, identity verification issues, where can they be brought to bear so that we are able to overcome some of these challenges that exist? So let me stop there. I've got plenty more we can talk about. I know we're going to get into, but hopefully that gives folks here a sense of what the infrastructure challenges are, especially when we're talking about the private sector. But I know we're going to really probe some of the infrastructure questions when it's government itself, in partnership with the financial sector, extending access to any type of benefit. And governments, both the federal and the states, are doing that quite extensively. And I think have built some really important plumbing that might be possible to leverage for purposes of thinking about some of these base needs and access goals.
Yeah, I love that infrastructure plumbing comes up. Infrastructure owns all metaphors in the United States, so through English, so it's always good to see the appearance. But in all seriousness, I mean, you know, let's just stack even more. Let's stack even more problems on top of what we heard on the last video. Even when Tom spoke positively, it ended up in a negative place. I mean, we have real challenges here. You know, Josh, I'm so glad you could join us. First of all, you and I both work a lot on transportation issues, which is in a good way. Transportation gets a little bit too much attention in the infrastructure sector, so it's glad we're the last one to speak in a way. But talk a lot. Look, folks who are probably listening today, they could be doing it mobily, right, if you will. You all are at the vanguard of, and it's not just VIA, right? This emerging transportation solution didn't exist 10 years ago, really, right? But all of the elements it requires, not only what Tom was speaking quite a bit about in terms of, yes, mobile, but basically telecommunication, but also what Melissa just introduced, right? I mean, it is a whole lot easier to interact with kind of modern transportation service companies if you are digitally banked. How is VIA grappling with this? And frankly, how are you collaborating with cities to think about innovative solutions, not only to the routing, but to get people into the potential system to provide the key service that you have?
A lot to talk about there. First of all, thank you, Adi and Brookings. It's wonderful to be, I guess, virtually here with you and with Melissa and Stacey. I guess starting quickly with affordability, it's a huge problem. So for many households in the U.S., transportation is often the second highest cost category after housing. And you know, you see families with incomes below $25,000 are much less likely to own a car than higher income households. And so affordability is a real challenge. It's something that cities are trying to address. More and more cities are experimenting with fare-free public transit, or in some cases with discounted transit. So for example, in New York City, where I live, the city introduced this Fair Fares program recently, which offers 50% discounted transit passes to families below the federal poverty line. But you know, as Melissa was talking about, you know, I think the same issues apply to transportation, where affordability is a huge challenge. But when we work with cities and policymakers, the conversation is really more broad than just affordability. It touches really on core issues around equity and access. So access to jobs and essential services, and really ability to access economic opportunity. And indeed, you know, as you know, and as you and some of your metropolitan policy colleagues have written extensively on, the linkages between physical mobility and economic mobility are profound and impossible to ignore in a conversation like this. You know, one study in San Diego found that car commuters could access 30 times the number of jobs than public transit commuters could. So basically higher income families who live in areas with more robust transit networks have more access to jobs and to ladders of economic opportunity than low income communities, and usually communities of color. And so this just perpetuates this drastic income gap that we have in this country. And you know, similar studies, many of them from Brookings, around the country have sort of similar results. And these disparities in access really have profound and lasting effects. One study by Raj Chetty and his colleagues found that actually commute times at the census tract level were a significant predictor of long-term upper mobility. So even for children, right? So children who grew up in areas with less robust public transportation have essentially lost out on economic opportunity because of that lack of access. So you know, affordability, but also critically access to safe, affordable, reliable transportation is really a core component of economic mobility and in building inclusive economies. So the work we do at VIA is we work with cities and transit agencies to design, develop, operate flexible on-demand transit systems that can be deployed really quickly and in a targeted way to improve mobility in communities. So riders will use a mobile app, or riders without smartphones, Aditi, your question about sort of the digital gap, can call an operator by phone and request a ride from wherever they are to their destination. Quite often it's a multimodal hub, so people are using this as a last mile connection to access, to get out of the transit deserts and connect to high volume fixed route transit networks. And other times it's a point-to-point service to connect people to essential services. And it's proven a flexible way to deploy transit in underserved areas more quickly than some traditional solutions could. And often, in particular in lower density areas and off-peak hours, in a more efficient way than a traditional sort of fixed route transit system. We have, because many of the services we operate are sort of designed to address transit deserts and to introduce services to traditionally underserved communities, we do take steps to make sure that that unbanked communities are included, whether through vouchers or cash payments or waived fares. And so happy to get into any of that in more detail later.
That was great, Josh. And let's kind of finish expanding the conversation to really one of the most well-known ways that we think about delivering benefits directly to those households in need. Stacy, thank you for being here. I can attest, I go to a whole lot of infrastructure events, virtually, in person, whatever. They rarely bring in someone who works on the nutrition side, except as the infrastructure community starts to think very seriously about this affordability idea, directly creating benefits, the portability of how you deliver those, a lot of the issues that Melissa and Josh has raised, I'm so delighted you're here. Because there are lessons that we need to take both from the SNAP and EBT system, and you're here to help explain those to us, right? So what can we learn? What's working? What's not? Both, again, on the kind of SNAP programming side, but also the EBT delivery.
Yeah, sure. Happy to jump in with that. And thanks for having me. This has been a great conversation. And I just think, you know, wrapping up from the first panel and this panel, as it it's a little obvious, but people with low or no income can't afford things, right? It's not just utilities. It's not just transportation. It's their rent. It's diapers. It's basic human needs issues. So, fundamentally, increasing income to those folks who are out of work or who aren't able to work is really the solution to a lot of these problems. But one of the things that you asked me to talk about today was SNAP, along with Medicaid, is an incredibly one of the most universal to reach. Low-income people in the month that they are low-income. I think that's important. There are many people in and out of poverty, and so SNAP captures them at those moments when they are low-income. And so could it be used as a mechanism to identify those who would be potentially eligible for some kind of subsidy for the infrastructure that we've talked about today? So let me just tick off a few things about SNAP so we all have the same baseline of information and then chat about whether it might work. So first, SNAP, which SNAP Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which used to be known as food stamps, is our nation's largest food assistance program. You might be surprised to know that today it reaches 1 in 8 Americans, or 43 million people, and that's July of this year number. The benefits are paid entirely by the federal government, but it's run by states, and it's an entitlement program, which means it can expand to need, which is why you saw 6 million people join the program between February and May, since so many more people became eligible as a result of COVID. Benefits can only be used to buy food, and they are issued on a debit card, which we call EBT, or electronic benefit transfer, and you use that to buy food at pre-qualified stores. The program's highly efficient and very targeted to low-income people. Household monthly gross income cannot exceed 130% of the poverty line, which for a family of three is about $2,300 a month. So it's a relatively strict eligibility standard. And households are pretty heavily scrutinized in the eligibility process, both who they are and what their current that month income and expenses are. So because of that, because it is really, it's also often called the program of last resort and the program with some of the most rigor in assessment. In our world, there's long been a conversation about how do our households in SNAP, can we allow them to pre-qualify for other things so we don't run duplicative assessments of need, given that SNAPs is so robust. And Tom Wheeler was a real champion of promoting this when he was at FCC to say anyone on SNAP should just pre-qualify for Lifeline services, both internet and phone. And we ought to be looking for uniform coverage there. And it's true, kids on SNAP pre-qualify for school free school meals, the WIC program. States often use a SNAP determination to pre-qualify people for childcare. It does not always mean that they'll get that benefit, because there may be other questions like, do you have a child who needs childcare? And there also can be caps on the amount that's available. But it's been long considered a robust system. So one question I think for the conversation is, are we looking just at whether households on SNAP pre-qualify for some kind of infrastructure subsidy? And then the second is, should that subsidy be delivered through SNAP, or could it happen through a different mechanism? So I'll stop there, because I think there's plenty to talk about.
No, that was great, Stacey. And that's exactly, raising that kind of specific mechanics question is exactly where I want to go. Open it up to all three of you. If we are kind of for a second talking about a universal program, and this is what we kind of heard in that first panel, was, hey, it's about people and it's a shared set of needs across these sectors. So if we were going to have some kind of universal program that kind of is like a SNAP for infrastructure, if you will, like just for a second to think about that, we don't have that right now. Nothing even close. So what would be the kind of mechanics that we need to start to think about, whether it's from the financial services side, whether it's from this kind of qualification element? There are anything you can kind of layer on here. And the reason we're asking this, to be clear, is as policymakers, practitioners start to think about this, this is what you've got to grapple with. It's enough to recognize the need, but we've got to think about actual mechanics here. So what are you all thinking about if we want to launch some kind of infrastructure affordability program?
Can I know, Adi, you want us to be somewhat engaging with each other, so I'm going to go ahead and jump right in. But more, a couple of things that I think are worth calling out. The SNAP program and the infrastructure, the beauty and elegance and efficiency is, you know, without question, as Stacey has talked about. I think it's also valuable to realize there are other government mechanisms for disbursement of benefits. And frankly, Stacey, from our prep conversation too, I dug back in, and it's tedious, but there are differences there. So the Treasury Department issues the Direct Express card. This is actually a prepaid card that U.S. Treasury facilitates issuance of in partnership with the financial sector in one particular institution. These are individual accounts, and it is a plumbing infrastructure that is enormously powerful, and billions are delivered annually through that government infrastructure. There are still, I think, so that's not the controversial part. But just to call out, there are other mechanisms by which the federal government and even the state governments, I mean, they use prepaid cards for lots of different disbursement purposes, employment benefits, et cetera. So I think keeping that in mind is one thing. We are a non-advocacy organization. Our purpose is really to just get some of these insights out for the conversation. So I'm not advocating for any particular mechanism. I'm just saying, make sure that we're thinking about the landscape of options, both that are in place right now, but that are also being contemplated in terms of financial access and financial inclusion. Another one that I would mention that's on the horizon is this idea of something called Fed accounts, where actually individuals, not just financial depository institutions, would have access to accounts that the Federal Reserve System would provide to individuals. And it's a big, bold idea, but it's getting some interest and some traction. Are there potential opportunities for leveraging that kind of significant plumbing? It's optional, but that kind of significant plumbing for people to then have a financial product or service that by which they could be both getting, you know, these sort of aggregated funds for paying these basic necessities. Could that plumbing infrastructure be something that would be useful there? So keeping all of that in mind, to Stacey's, I think, really good question, is there an infrastructure even with SNAP that could be, you know, used as especially sort of this initial and efficient way of qualifying individuals for significant benefits infrastructure? That's a great question, but I also think we have to also consider there are people who may not be able to participate in the SNAP program, or frankly, even the Direct Express program, who legally have a right to financial access. And I'm thinking about, I mean, the latest numbers are almost up to 10 million undocumented individuals in this country who need transit capabilities, and they need an infrastructure to be able to make those payments digitally. And so how do we sort of consider that sort of marginal of marginal populations who also are going to need these basic needs and services? So as we think about the benefits of using existing government infrastructure, let's also keep in mind how far that gets us and how far we still need to push ourselves to consider, you know, those additional families who are also in need of broadband, of transportation, while they may not be eligible for some of our government provided funds like SNAP benefits.
So I think that's not at all. I think it's an excellent point. SNAP reaches 85% of eligible people in the month, right? It's not over the course of a year. So it has a very high enrollment rate. But you're right, not every low-income person is eligible for SNAP. The way that Lifeline handled that, and that many other, where you have a cross-connection, is to say everyone on SNAP pre-qualifies, or if you can illustrate, if you can demonstrate, show your letter of enrollment in SNAP, which many households can download from their online account, you're in, right? And then the question is, do you create an application process for those who aren't otherwise in, or you can bridge forward by bringing in other programs that have a more comprehensive review. So that, I think you make an excellent point. I'm not saying that's perfectly solvable, because I think you'll always have to have some kind of application process, but maybe for the purposes of this conversation, we could just talk about using this one as a platform, knowing that it would have to be improved and built upon. I think to me, a state or even a community, particularly a county, could right now say, you know, we want to provide subsidies for and pick, you know, utility or transportation X, for example, a bus pass or, you know, again. And the idea would be, what are some of the issues there? One is just getting either, you're going to have to say to the individual, you have to prove you're on SNAP or Program X, and that will pre-qualify you, or you get the ability to data share the enrollment so that you can provide the benefit. There are some logistical issues there, but it's not impossible because it's done right now. So for example, WIC, which is a program that just provides a it provides really valuable nutrition counseling and targeted benefits to women, infants, and children at early ages of life. It has, when someone walks into a WIC clinic and says, you know, I'd like to apply, that clinic almost always has the ability to ping SNAP and just say, are they enrolled? And they just get a yes or a no. And if it's yes, they are pre-qualified for WIC. If it's a no, then they, you know, the individual is handed a form to fill out. So I think these are the kinds of things that there's a lot of experience on the benefit delivery side. The question is, where's the money to pay for the subsidy? If we're talking federally, I really think the first available dollar should go to increase food or cash assistance overall, so families can decide what they want. But I think locally, you know, you could absolutely experiment with this mechanism of targeting infrastructure assistance through some form of, you know, a pre-qualification system.
Stacey, I want you to hold that thought, because we'll have time for one audience question after Josh Jensen, but it's exactly what you just raised. But Josh, let me throw it to you for some mechanics.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I just quickly on mechanics, you know, as Stacey was suggesting, in many cases, the easiest way to sort of validate eligibility is just by cross-reference to other programs or other thresholds. So for example, Fair Fares in New York is tied to the federal poverty line. In other cases, eligibility for transit or transportation assistance is tied to Medicaid eligibility or other programs. The way we've done it in some cases is just by directly sort of geofencing areas and really targeting service delivery directly to the communities that, when we work with our partner cities, that we identify together as those most in need. So for example, in Los Angeles, we partner with LA Metro to provide first and last mile connections on on-demand basis in three low-income communities around El Monte, Compton, and North Hollywood. And so riders in those areas now have access that they never had before to an on-demand system that will bring them to Metro Rail and MetroLink metro stops, and it's considered a free transfer. So sometimes you can just directly provide the service in those particular areas In other cases, we've done that with food. So, you know, many low-income students rely on the federal school lunch program for nutrition. And so when schools closed down during COVID, they lost access to that source. And so sort of providing the, you know, tying the eligibility in this case to this new benefit, which is sort of delivering those meals. We took the roster of students from schools and Genuine Foods, who we partnered with in DC, and just essentially brought that fresh produce to the students' homes so that they can maintain access to that lifeline during COVID.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, let's think about all the stuff we heard, and then we'll get to this last question. So we've got, we're talking about data at one point, security, connecting to other programs, food and nutrition link up. One thing we kind of almost didn't touch on that's interesting, right, is we've got effectively different affordability targets based on cost of living in different markets. You've got different providers. We talked on the last one. I just want to stress this. There is a lot to do on this. If we want to develop even a state-based, or certainly, as Stacey was talking about, all the work that's gone into SNAP, right, a universal-like, if not formally universal, federal program here. So this leads into one question that is perfect, because we had kind of talked about in advance, and Stacey just alluded to it. Should we be having targeted programs here? Or is the problem that we effectively don't have enough money in people's pockets, especially those who income related are most disadvantaged, most vulnerable right now? So we're going to close on that. It's an almost unfair question to answer quickly, but I have to ask you for it because of the, you know, the lords of recording here are going to require us to stop. They're going to like turn off the lights on us. So in as quickly as you can, should we be developing targeted programs, or is there a different debate that we should be having concurrently about actually just expanding income for those who are most, again, income-related vulnerable?
So, well, I'm going to punt on that question. This is not our particular area of expertise, so I'll yield my time to the other two guests. But it's a really critical question, and lots of thought needs to go into it.
Well, look, I'll absolutely make the case for expanding cash assistance to low-income individuals and households. The number of children who are now living in households with no income, let alone how much are eligible and receiving cash assistance compared to 20 years ago, it's stunningly much lower. So that's, to me, that's the paramount federal priority. And if ever there were a time when the weakness of the poor cash safety net were exposed, this is it. But that doesn't preclude, I think, localities, counties, states for looking at building out other forms of support to address some of these infrastructure issues. So I don't feel like it's completely an either or. To me, it's just a sequence of priorities.
Josh. Yeah, just quickly, I'm glad Stacey opened the door to the sort of both and answer. You know, I think there's a very compelling case to be made for increased cash assistance. And I think that, you know, that's something that absolutely we should do. I just think it's insufficient by itself, because even, you know, particularly on the transportation side, even if households sort of could afford a transit fare, in many cases, there's just no access. The system isn't there. So we need to invest in expanding access to transit, to food, to broadband, water, all these essential utilities.
Yeah, great way to end. Look, this is not going anywhere. The four of us know it. I think everyone who's watching right now knows it. It doesn't matter what happens in November, not just for the president, but in the House and the Senate, and in state races. I mean, we are in a significant economic recession, and preceding it, people could not afford their bills before it. The question is, what are we gonna do about it? And there's a lot of concurrent debates happening at the same time. The need is real, it's expansive. That creates policy competition. So what I'm hoping comes out of this conversation for folks who are listening in, and you heard from the panelists today, this touches on a multi-sector approach. It's about people. It touches on our peers that work in nutrition and in digital and financial inclusion. There's a broad set of things happening here, and we're going to have to collaborate together to come up with solutions. We're excited to hear where the three of your work keeps going. Stacey, Melissa, Josh, as well as the prior panel, a big thank you again to the mayor for making time when his schedule is certainly pressing at this moment. Thanks again, everyone. You can find the work that Josh, Melissa, Stacey do, as well as the prior panelists with their respective organizations. We'll have a link up to this video if you want to send it around to your friends. Enjoy the rest of your day, and thanks for making your time with us.